Hi guys, today we are going to be talking to the incredible Ben Smith from the 401 Challenge, finding out all about his new challenge across America in 2022. Tell me a bit about your background before you found running. As far as you like. Bring it all the way back.
Now, let's just put it that way.
Okay.
But yeah, I grew up in a military family.
Mm-hmm.
So I had from an early age the ability to kind of travel the world and see amazing things and kind of meet lots of different types of people and, you know, live in different countries and learn different languages. So it was quite an exciting kind of first 10 years of my life, really.
Mm-hmm.
And me, my mum, my dad, and my brother just kind of, we had an adventure. It was fun. But unfortunately, kind of all that changed at the age of 10 when I went away to school.
Okay.
So unfortunately, my parents lived out in Germany and it meant that I had to come to school in the UK.
Right.
So I had to come away from home,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I didn't know what boarding school was, to be perfectly honest with you. I didn't know Harry Potter existed back then, to be perfectly honest.
No.
We're talking 1992 here. So, God, the 90s.
I was born in the 80s, if that helps you.
Me too, 82. I'm almost 40. Like, seriously, what's going on? I ended up at a school in Nottingham.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But unfortunately, this school was very different to anything I'd really ever experienced before. And I suppose you could say the kids spoke a completely different language to me. You know, I've been brought up by my mum and dad to kind of think, you know, that I could do anything that I put my mind to,
mm-hmm.
you know, they instilled me with confidence and self-esteem and to know my own voice and to kind of value things that weren't necessarily materialistic.
Okay.
Whereas the school I went to, all they really cared about was the car that their mum and dad drove or the money that they had or the clothes that they wore. And
okay.
I suppose that's why I said it's like a different language.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after a couple of weeks, you know, they started to talk to me about the fact that they didn't have any of this stuff, and it actually made me feel quite bad.
Right.
But, you know, I'd still had 10 years worth of my mum and dad telling me to know my own mind. And, you know, so I kind of held it out for a little while, but after no time at all, really, when you hear things from other people that, you know, aren't very nice, you start to believe it. And, you know, it starts to change who you are. So I did. And unfortunately, my confidence and self-esteem just kind of dropped away. And I just became a bit of a shell, really.
Okay.
I was bullied for quite a number of years for being different.
Mm-hmm.
At 13, I actually realised I figured out that I was gay. And that terrified the life out of me because, again, you know, not only was I different in the fact that I didn't have all this other stuff, now it was actually really different.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't want to be attacked, so I felt I had to cover it all up. That's what I did for the next kind of 5 years until I was 18. And then, unfortunately, at 18, it all had got too much, and I tried to take my own life at school. Obviously, I did. You know, I'm here.
Thank goodness for that.
Yeah. I never know whether to say I wasn't successful. It depends on how you view it, really.
Of course.
And, you know, I sat at home. I remember my mum and dad finding out about the bullying. You know, I didn't come out. I didn't talk about my sexuality or anything like that. You know, I covered that up completely for quite a number of more years afterwards. But I suppose the toll of all the bullying and that had an impact on me massively. So I sat at home kind of at 18 thinking I should know what I want to do in life. I had no bloody clue, and I ended up going to university in Middlesbrough studying a psychology degree, which I'm sure the irony is not lost on any of you. I just kind of ended up getting myself into a bit of a bad crowd. I was quite easily influenced, didn't really study much, and just did more of the partying and more of the, you know, that type of stuff, because, you know, to me, I thought it was me figuring myself out and finding myself and what I wanted, and actually I wasn't. I was falling deeper and deeper into depression, and there was nobody there to help me.
No.
I tried to take my own life for a second time in Middlesbrough, and I ended up in James Cook.
Wow. Okay.
This was back ages ago. I'm sure it's changed now, but I remember them having to put me on a drip to kind of clear the tablets that they'd taken. And I just remember feeling like they just looked at me like I was a piece of, excuse my French, but a piece of shit. Like I was a waste of time for them. And I think that just kind of cemented to me that actually, to be honest with you, you know, nothing's going to change in my life. This is the way I need, this is the way I'm going to live it. Covering up who I was, doing what other people wanted. And that was it. That was what my life was going to be. So that's what I did. I spent the next 10, 11 years of my life doing that all the way up till 29. And, you know, I managed to get a successful job and I got everything on paper that you would deem to be successful, all the tick boxes and stuff like that. This invisible trust, this we all seem to aspire to, but
it's the way society tells us we need to be, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of almost is like we're all chasing this goal, and actually, do we want it? And I thought I did. And, you know, I was very successful by the time I was 29 years old. I got married to a woman, and we bought a house, had a nice car, and, you know, multiple holidays. I had everything that you would deem to be successful on paper, so to speak. And I thought I was happy, but unfortunately, I let myself go quite badly from a health point of view, and I ended up having a stroke 29 years old, where I lost my sight, my hearing, and my feeling in my left arm, the ability to talk. And thankfully, that was downgraded to a TIA because the symptoms started to wear off, and very, very bloody lucky, to be perfectly honest with you.
Absolutely.
But it shook me up. It shook me up massively. And, you know, I kind of didn't realise when they said to me that I'd had this TIA, what it all meant. But, you know, I was 17 and a half stone. I was a 40-a-day smoker. I drank myself under the table every single day. And I didn't, you know, I covered up who I was, who I am. And, you know, all this kind of latent stress was just building. And, of course, it was going to happen. So I knew I needed to do something after that, and it basically took the form of me telling my ex-wife that I was gay and was getting divorced and moving out. But nothing else really changed. Carried on working 80 hours a week in a job I hated, and carried on smoking, carried on drinking. And if anything, I thought, you know, I've done the thing that I need to do. I've come out, sort of done. But that was just the beginning, really. And it took a year until a friend of mine actually pulled me up about it in a pub in Bristol, funnily enough, over a pint of cider. It's one of your 5 day down here.
Well, it's fruit, is it not?
It is fruit, yeah.
These days you can get ciders with a lot of fruit in it. A lot of different fruits.
Yeah, more of a Thatcher's town myself, so it's only 4 miles down the road, so it's fine. It's
handy.
Like 1 month through it most days. Yeah. But yeah, it was a friend of mine that kind of took me up, pulled me up about it all, and she sat me down and she went, look, you complain and moan about the fact that you want to get fit and healthy, but you're not actually doing anything about it. And actually, I'm sure a lot of people can kind of resonate to that. Well, I was scared. I was terrified because I thought, you know, I don't feel brave enough to put myself forward for certain things, and I just thought I'd done enough. But, you know, She held me to account, and I said, well, look, what do you want me to do about it? She went, I'm glad you asked. She said, why don't you come join my running club? To which I think I'll find out whatever it cost me in running.
What a waste of fruit.
Well, to be honest with you, I was the guy that used to drive past runners with a fag hanging out the car window thinking that they were a bunch of weirdos, because I thought, why in God's green earth would you ever want to dress up in micro? Why do you want to wear shorts and a vest in the middle of freezing cold winter? You know, what is wrong with you people? And also I had this kind of idea that was born out of my experiences of sport from school, that actually if I did sport, I needed to be the best at it, and also I needed to be good at it. And if I didn't have any of that, then I would hate it. And actually, what I found when I joined this running club in Bristol, it started and ended at a pub, by the way, so the best running club is well.
Happy days.
It was a complete sea of different types of people. I joined the Couch to 5K group on the first night. Mm-hmm. They were running a 5K. Not great timing. But I remember, you know, doing that and thinking, oh my God, this hurts. But for the first time in 20 years, I suppose I felt something. And I suppose that's the sadistic thing that I suppose a lot of people don't get, but I actually felt something. It wasn't like I suddenly fell in love with running. I just felt something and actually went, oh, actually, I want to feel that again. So I went again and again and again, and, you know, once a week turned into twice a week. And I think I was spending about £4 a month because you had to pay 50p every time you went to my running club.
Wow.
You know? But okay. Every step almost and every kind of interaction I had, there was no judgment from anybody in the club. When we were in our running kit, we were all the same, no matter our abilities. And we'd go out on the trails, we'd go out on the roads, and we'd just talk, we'd have a chat. It was a sociability of running that really was what pulled me in.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually felt stronger being part of it.
Yeah.
I found this love for a sport that I never ever thought was going to be something that was going to be part of my life.
Yeah.
And actually, it helped me grow as an individual. And over the first 6 months, I managed to run my first half marathon and then signed up to run my first marathon, which was in Brighton in 2013.
Okay.
And, I downloaded the 16-week training program about a month before.
Yikes.
So you can kind of imagine how that all went. I crossed the line. I don't know if you've ever seen, but on YouTube there's this thing called the 7 stages of marathon running.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen video?
I've seen that. Yeah.
Felt every moment. And I can pinpoint exactly where I felt it as well. But yeah, it was just, I think crossing that finishing line, I'd love to say that I ran across it with my arms outside, but I didn't. I face planted on the finishing line and that struck me off. They've got this foil blanket around me, which I had no clue what to do with. Who does? And then they handed me a bottle of water with the lid was still on. And obviously your brain doesn't work after 26 miles. So I'm sat there looking at it thinking, I know what it is, but you know, I don't know what to do with it. And then somebody put a medal around my neck.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't so much the materialism of the medal, it was the symbolism of it. You know, a year before, I'd been stood at the front door of a running club thinking I'd never, ever belong to, you know, this type of thing. I'd never enjoy it. I actually even thought that my heart would beat so fast that I'd die. You know, all these little crazy things, all these barriers that you put up in front of yourself to protect yourself, I felt them all.
Yeah.
And over the course of a year, all I found was love and support and all my friends had helped me kind of grow into this person, and I just, you know, not in a clean way, but, you know, I just completed a marathon. And the power and the sense of achievement and accomplishment that gives you,
yeah,
it was huge. Mm-hmm. And I was hooked, absolutely hooked. So I signed up for the second one, which was Amsterdam in the September.
Okay.
Loved it. And then I signed up for 18. It was initially 14, but then it ended up being 18 marathons in 2014. All around the world, as
mm-hmm.
you do.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I was starting, if you imagine, my journey was, I was figuring out who I was, what I wanted out of life, what made me happy in life, rather than all this kind of predisposed stuff that I've been fed for 20-odd years.
Yeah.
And running was helping me kind of clean all that out of my system. It was giving me time to think. It was giving me time to kind of process stuff. And it gave me the confidence to be able to go and talk to somebody about all the things that I've been through.
Okay.
And actually, I remember coming out of my final counselling session and saying to myself, you know, I want to use what's happened to me for good. I don't know what it looks like yet.
Yeah.
And throughout that whole period, I was running marathons around the world and, you know, having a great time. I was going out on my own. I was exploring myself and what I wanted out of life and, you know, seeing these amazing countries. And it was incredible. And then I came up with this idea of, okay, well, I want to do a challenge, but what's that going to look like? I knew I liked marathon running. I'd done probably, I think it was about 30 marathons by this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, what, you know, there was this thing of, I'd heard about ultra running.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh God, I don't know if I'll be able to do that. You know, there was a scary thing.
Yeah.
A scary thought. I thought, well, why don't I do back-to-back marathons? Which in a way is kind of a bit ultra-y, but depends on who you talk to, really.
It's so, a bit like a multi-stage, is it not?
Well, yeah, I suppose, yeah. But yeah, it seemed to kind of fit more with what I wanted, really. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I want to raise some money. How much do you want to raise? And I kind of picked £250,000 out of the air. And then realised quite quickly that in order to raise £250,000, you've got to do something quite big. So I started to look at what the biggest thing in back-to-back marathon money was.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you look at what the world record is, don't you? That I think at the time was 53, a Japanese guy that ran 106 times around a running track. That's what we found. But, you know, I didn't have any knowledge of the running industry whatsoever. You know, I'd never been part of it. I'd never trained properly and never had any of that kind of knowledge. So we kind of could really go on what we could find. And when I found this dude, I was like, well, I don't want to run 106 times around a running track.
No.
For 54 days.
No.
I don't see why I would want to do that. I don't think anybody else would want to do that. No. So, well, actually, part of what I wanted from the project was for me to be able to bottle up what I'd experienced from running and be able to give that to people.
Yeah.
So that they could find their own happiness, their own kind of, you know, sense of what they wanted out of life. And that wasn't going to happen around a running track.
No.
So I decided that, you know, I also got the list from Guinness, the Guinness Book of World Records, and I just looked at it and I went, well, that kills the fun, doesn't it? So I basically went, well, we ain't going to apply for the world record, but let's go beat it anyway.
Yeah.
So that's what we set out to do. And kind of over the course of about 4 or 5 months, you know, friends of mine were sending me kind of like snippets and articles from people that had done kind of multi-stage kind of days. And I think there was like 100 and 250 and one every day for a year. Then there was something of a dude that had done 607 or was thinking of doing it at the time. We couldn't quite remember. And then there was a claim of a monk that had done 1,000 for Zen. Right. And I thought, oh my God, really? But I think the ones we could really verify at the time were the kind of ones for a year. So we decided, well, look, let's take that as the milestone.
Okay.
And let's round it up. So we rounded it up to 400 because I like clean numbers. And then I went off to the US in April of 2015, where I got to run as part of a multi-stage event, 7 marathons in 7 days across 7 US states.
Okay.
Part of a mainly marathons.
Mm-hmm.
So I ran down the Mississippi River from St. Louis down to New Orleans. It was amazing. I got to meet this incredible dude called Larry Macon, who is an ultra runner in his own right, really. He's done, I believe, over 1,800 marathons in his lifetime. I think he's the current world record holder for the most amount of marathons run in a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember meeting him, being a little bit kind of like awestruck about this dude. I think he's in his 80s now. but yeah, I told him what I was going to do, thinking he'd just laugh at me, and didn't.
Mm-hmm.
He just said, that's awesome. That's amazing. But have you thought of a victory lap? And I went, what? Thinking, are you a nutcase? And also my British sensibilities, you know what we're like? We're like, well, that's a bit too American, guys.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But the more and more I thought about it, I kind of went, you know what, I quite like the idea of that. Because as I said before, part of the whole project was about getting people involved.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than just being one voice around the movement, let's make multiple voices so we're a lot louder.
Yeah.
And actually, the last... having a victory lap at the very end, which was going to be the 401 marathon,
mm-hmm.
It would allow people to come and join in and take part about the country and really kind of finish it off and make a big deal of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, we added the one, and April 2015 was when the 401 challenge was born. So I then had to make my mind up about quitting my job,
yeah,
selling my house, selling everything I own, buying a camper van. And then on the 1st of September, I started in Bristol.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's kind of, I suppose, the rest is history, really.
For the listeners who may not know what the 401 is, 401 marathons in 401 days, you raised a hell of a lot of money.
and you ran with a lot of people around the UK. An awful lot of people.
Like the Northeast. Yeah, we ran with, I think it was 13,500 people. We totaled it.
Okay.
It was based on the number of selfies I had on my phone. So we tried to take a selfie with everybody we ran with. Obviously, you know, that doesn't account for organised marathons like the London or Brighton
of course.
Or Manchester or Reading, etc. I couldn't do that. Could you imagine? I never have finished the race.
You didn't have enough space on your phone.
No.
I'm not surprised.
But yeah, you know, we set out for it to be consecutive to begin with, but that unfortunately didn't end up happening because on day 285, I was in the northeast of Scotland, kind of Aberdeen area.
Okay.
And progressively from the Edinburgh Marathon at the end of May up towards Aberdeen, I started to kind of lose the bottom of my back. It's probably the best way I can describe it, but I ended up going from standing up straight to being quite wonky and twisted and not being able to really run. Not being able to walk. I could run because my body was so adapted to doing that.
Yeah.
And that was the only thing I could really do, but I couldn't sleep or walk or sit or anything. So my rest time was completely and utterly screwed.
Mm-hmm.
And my other half, Kyle and my dad, who were both kind of project managing it, they said that I needed to go to hospital. So I did.
Yeah.
And they then told me I needed to stop. To which I started to negotiate because I didn't actually realize what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get my own way, let's just put it that way. So I was taken off the road for, at the time, we didn't know how long it was going to be, but it ended up being 10 days.
Yeah.
And throughout that 10 days, I had scans and stuff, and they figure out that I'd actually fractured my back in a couple of places at the bottom. One of the discs had slipped and ruptured, and it created my spine twist because all the muscles then start to compensate. So I was in a pretty bad mess, really.
Yeah.
I ended up going to see a therapist and a physio and kind of, excuse the pun, but straighten myself back out again.
Yeah.
I ended up back on the road 10 days later in Inverness, which is where but would have been 10 days after coming off the road in Aberdeen. So
yeah.
Unfortunately, I missed out this really beautiful bit of coastline, which is where I used to live, and Peterhead and kind of Ellen and around all that way.
Yeah.
I said to myself that instead of running a marathon every day, I was going to run a bit more to make up the 262 miles that we've missed out on.
Yeah.
So what that meant was rather than it being consecutive, it ended up being the distance of 401 marathons in 401 days.
Yeah.
So you could probably argue 401 marathons in 391 days, but it doesn't have the same ring to it. Really,
no, it doesn't.
Does it? But yeah, I ended up, I think the most I ran was 38 miles, and that was in Pontefract. Is past as an ultra? I'm not sure. I don't know what the definition of an ultra is anymore. I think over a marathon, isn't it? I don't know. I think people get a bit touchy about the whole thing, don't they? But
technically, it's with anything over a marathon. A lot of people say that it's called the 50, which is 31. So yeah, 38 yeah. is definitely.
Well, what's the bit between? I just argue, what's the bit between? It's like no man's land, I suppose.
A long marathon, I've heard.
A long marathon where you've gone a bit wrong.
Uh-huh.
But
you've got lost.
What I found, yeah. Well, I think what I found was that the British public and the people that came out and ran just rallied around what we were doing, and it was incredible. And what you ended up finding was that we didn't want the project to be about me. We wanted it to be about the cause and why, and actually it ended up being about that, which was great.
Yeah,
because it started to become its own, how do I describe this, but like I've never really been able to properly pinpoint exactly what it was, but you used to get people rock up in the morning who'd never run more than like a couple of miles in their life before.
Yeah.
They weren't physically fit, they were just, you know, normal people. But they were so hell bent on joining in because what it was for.
Yeah.
And they'd either been through something or their kids are going through something or they knew somebody, and they got behind the reason. And because we took the mentality of the fact that, you know, almost a little bit like an ultra mentality,
mm-hmm.
you know, it wasn't about running a fast marathon every single day. That wasn't the point. It was about getting to the end of 401 days. How we did that, it was going to, you know, meant that we had to go slower, or I chose to run at the pace of the slowest runner, which made it a bit more kind of inclusive for people.
Mm-hmm.
And actually what we found was that over 1,600 people ended up running further than they'd ever run before.
Yeah.
Of which I think it was over 500 or 600 of those ended up running either their first marathon or first ultra marathon. And I remember there were a couple of people that, again, had never run more than 2 miles in their life before, and then by the end of the day, they'd run a marathon. You're like, this shouldn't actually happen. But because we put the fun, and because we'd taken away the pressure,
yeah,
and because they were so impassioned with the cause, it just, things became possible.
Yeah.
And actually, that's what I found from running over the years. Running has given me the ability to become the person I am today.
Yeah.
And I'm incredibly grateful for it. I really am. But yeah, it's to go from, what, it's almost 10 years since my TIA.
Wow.
It's coming to, what, yeah, it'd be 10 years. Yeah, it'd be flipping out. Yeah, almost 10 years. And yeah, my life has literally done a 180 completely.
Yeah.
I'm the happiest I've ever been. Don't get me wrong, I still have daily stress, of course, you know, especially with technology and stuff like that. But yeah.
Sorry.
Sorry.
You apologise. Working from home. Say. I know. Can you imagine?
But yeah. You know, my life has changed massively from it.
Yeah.
It's given me the opportunity to do some amazing things.
Mm.
I feel very privileged for it. But I think at the end of the day, you know, we were really proud of what the last project achieved.
Absolutely. You know,
yes, we raised £330,000, which is amazing. And yes, it won a load of awards, which was fab. But I think, going back to what I was saying before, it was the impact that it had on people.
Yeah.
That was really, really important. And actually, we didn't want that to just fizzle out. So that's when we set up the Mental Health Foundation that we now have, called the 401 Foundation.
Yeah.
That's what we've been working ever since. So.
Really. Picking up on some things from your past, from your background then, how did your family take when you told them who you really were? Did they respond well?
Yeah, completely. Yeah, my mum... you know, my mum and dad, if you had two parents, they could have written a textbook on how to react to your son or daughter coming out. They'd have written it. You know, they didn't care. They actually didn't care. It's actually a really funny story. I remember having to. So at the time, I was still kind of doing all the bad stuff that I was doing.
Okay.
Still working, still smoking, still drinking, all of that. And I decided that I was going to drive from Bristol back to home in Lincoln, which is where Mum and Dad live now.
Okay.
What is a 3-hour journey?
Mm-hmm.
Took me about 8.
Wow.
I stopped off near every single service station and smoked back in the fags because I was so worried. So nervous, and I was playing it over in my head as to how I thought that they were going to react, even though deep down I knew that both my parents were two of the most open-minded parents in the world. You know,
yeah.
My mum's, you know, she's both my parents retired now. But, you know, my dad's very black and white, or used to be, isn't so much anymore. He's kind of grey at the minute. but yeah, he's ex-military, you know, quite a matter of fact in that sense. Whereas my mum, you know, she's like an ex-holistic healer. You know, she thinks she can talk to dead people. It's like, you know, two very different parents.
Absolutely.
But both very loving and very open, very supportive. And, you know, I was very lucky to have two parents like that. So, you know, by the time I got home, my brother, bless him, he was an ex-professional rugby player.
Okay.
He'd just finished his professional career, and he got his first job post-professional career. So he was on the phone to them for about 2 hours. So I get through the door and I'm like, oh my God. And then I've got to wait a couple of hours while they all finish, and then literally I usher them into the living room. It's like, honestly, it's like I'm telling them that I'm going to die. That's how dramatic it almost ends up.
Yeah.
And, you know, by the time I kind of got to this whole thing of, like, you know, telling them that I thought I was gay, you know, my dad had got bored and he was starting to read the paper. You know, remember, she's there on the edge of her seat, glued, you know, like this, you know, because that's my... And then my dad just pops the paper and goes, and?
Wow. I'm like,
okay, didn't expect that. expected something a bit more. And mum, she starts to cry, and I'm like, oh my God, I thought it was going to be the other way around, if anything. It turns out mum's just like, oh my God, I'm so proud of you.
Aww.
This is amazing. Oh, I love you. We love you. And obviously, it got a bit emotional, of course.
Of course.
And then she turns around and she starts saying, well, this is great now because we can go shopping, we can go to Gay Pride, and we can do all of that stuff. And I'm like, okay, I might have come out, but I've not changed. So.
No, no. Yeah, just, I will not be picking outfits with you.
No. There were a couple of jokes of her saying, well, you can't wear my shoes, and I'm just a bit like, oh, all right, get them all out, come on. But no, it's just, yeah, I know a lot of people that have had very different experiences
to come out.
I was just very lucky, you know, if anything, it just cemented inside me that actually who I was or who I am is good.
Yeah.
And actually, it's right to be who I am. You know, I'm very lucky now. I got married not last year, the year before. God, I keep saying last year, but obviously we've had a year of COVID, haven't we? So that's kind of like wiped a year off our lives. But, yeah, I got married in. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I got married in. What were we? 2019, November of 2019.
Okay.
And it's been. He's amazing. It's just. He hated running.
Oh dear.
Couldn't stand it. Yeah, but now he runs 3-5 Ks a week. Yeah, and he motivates me half the time. So
he blames his love of running on you, completely.
Well, I don't know whether or not he'd admit to the love of running, even though he runs 3-5 Ks a week. But he comes home and when he's run a 5K under 30 minutes, he's very proud of. I would be proud because you know I struggle to do that most times. He's got this kind of like grin on his face.
Aww.
Nailed it. So, but yeah, it's brilliant.
Secret.
I'm very happy.
Secret love of running. We'll go with secret love of running.
Let's go secret love of running. Yeah. He almost felt the best though. He has actually run a marathon. He ran the marathon in 2017 So my mum and dad weren't able to take part physically in the challenge, but they obviously supported it. My liaised with health professionals around the UK because of her background, and my dad, using his logistical kind of background, worked with different running clubs.
Okay.
There's over 209 different running clubs we worked with around the UK to plan different routes.
Wow.
And that's, I think, why we ended up with so many people joining in. But his mum and dad... his mum ended up running her first marathon, which was on the final day. And her dad and his dad ended up running 31 marathons with me, which was the most amount of marathons anybody ran with me in the whole thing.
Wow.
You know, so it kind of, you know, I think he might have felt the pressure that he needed to run a marathon. So he signed up to the London Marathon half expecting that he wouldn't get in. He did. and then we ran it together in 2017 and... it's a bit nuts.
That's always the way, though, isn't it? You sign up kind of hoping that you're not going to get in, and then you do.
Well, I think that's how it works. I don't know whether or not the London Marathon got this like, secret and mental connection to people, but if you don't want it, you're going to get in. If you want it, you'll never get in. That seems to be the thing when you see it, don't you? It's like, I've been trying for so many years, and I've never got in. And then somebody's like, well, I signed up, and... oh, I've got a place. Oh, God, I've got a train now.
I have been very, very much wanted rejections under my belt. Oh. So I might, next year, I'm like,
just
no.
Don't want it. Just don't want it anymore. Just don't want to sign up and go, I'll never get it. Guarantee you.
Doesn't matter. Don't want to do it in the first place. Yes. So tell me about your mission to promote mental well-being. That's a really, really big thing.
Yeah, well, I think it kind of spans on my background, really. You know, mm-hmm. my whole journey right the way through, you know, my childhood, my adulthood, kind of, you know, like I've said in this interview, it was very much about doing things that other people wanted from me and, yeah. you know, listening to other people's voices rather than my own, and that having an impact on my confidence and self-esteem, which then overall had an impact on my mental well-being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't feel brave or have the ability to do the things I wanted to do because I thought, well, they were wrong.
Yeah.
You know, finding running gave me that strength, it gave me that belief, and then kind of going on and doing the 401 challenge, which a lot of people thought was nigh on impossible,
mm-hmm.
especially for a guy like myself, you know, to come out the other end of that, to actually change people's minds and for them to think, well, actually, okay, if he can do that, then, you know, maybe I can do this. That kind of then lit that fire inside our head of going, well, actually, you know, there's something about building someone's confidence, building someone's self-esteem, mm-hmm. making them feel like, you know, making them feel like they're worth something, which they are, mm-hmm. because we're very good at knocking ourselves down. We're very good at knocking other people down as well. And actually yeah. what we don't realize is the ramifications that that has on someone's kind of belief.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people asked me why I think I was successful in what I did with the 401, and it comes down to finding the things that made me happy.
Okay.
Running makes me happy, travel makes me happy, being around people makes me happy. So actually putting all that together, running for two causes that were really important to me,
yeah,
you know, the motivation was there, and I was able to pick up on different threads of motivation, whether or not that was food related or coffee related or travel related or people related or cause related, whatever.
Yeah.
I was able to pick up on it because it was the right thing and I was doing what I wanted to do, not what was being taken from me.
Yeah.
As I was running around the UK, I was being taught, I was being told about all these different community projects, all these different people that had all these amazing ideas about, you know, instilling confidence in people and self-esteem in people. And a lot of them were running related, but there were a lot of other community projects. And one of the big things that we were hearing as well was the fact that their funding was being cut.
Right.
Kind of brought, well, it just seems to me like local community projects, when I grew up, were the backbone of a community.
Mm-hmm.
And actually the people in charge of them are the people with the ideas in the community knew their people best because they lived and breathed in that community.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying national charities don't know people, but oh. they have a national approach rather than a local community approach. And we've seen that so much more now, you know, over the past mm-hmm. year and a half, COVID, you know, the growth in community spirit and support of volunteering, things like that.
Yeah.
So all of this put together into a big mishmash pot came out in the form of the 401 Foundation, which is a grant-giving organisation that supports local community projects and individuals to build their confidence and self-esteem, but also tackle issues around mental health and self-development.
Mm-hmm.
What we try and do is empower and help people to make positive change within their community.
Yeah.
You know, we believe that everybody should feel, everybody should be able to find what makes them happy in life. And it's, you know, it might sound like quite an out there statement, but it's quite a simple statement. But the solution to getting to that problem is quite complex.
Yeah.
So for the past couple of years, what we've done is we've had to build from scratch. You know, we're not a legacy charity in the sense of we've not got shed loads of money. We've had to generate our own money. You know, that parts of that money has gone to build the infrastructure of the foundation because, you know, we need to try and make sure that we're sustainable for the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years. You know, we don't just want to be a flash in the pan.
Sure.
Nobody's paid. You know, we're all volunteers. We have a very small team, and unfortunately, COVID has had an impact on that.
Yeah.
But what we've managed to do is really establish through an incredible board of trustees a really defined view of what we want to achieve over the next 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that has come in the form of needing investment to be able to do that, which is where the USA Challenge, which is the next challenge, comes in, basically. Mm-hmm. So, just to kind of put a bit of context on that, the next challenge, which is obviously now being confirmed, we've funded it, and that's been funded through the 401 challenge, which is our commercial business. None of it's being paid for by the charity, it's all being paid for by me, an income that I generate from talks that I do or books that we sell or clothing that we sell, etc., that is 401 challenge related.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm going to be going to the US, and starting on the 10th of May next year, I will be running and cycling 14,000 miles around all 50 US states,
yeah.
Starting in Maine, ending in Hawaii, and that's going to be over 104 days. So, yeah, 4,000 miles more than the last one in quite a number of days left.
Yeah.
But this time it's unaided.
Yeah.
So it's a solo project, mm-hmm. me and my bike and my trainers. So it's, yeah, it's quite scary. But the aim's to raise £500,000 for the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And the money that we hope to raise for the foundation, half of that will go to support local community projects,
mm-hmm.
go straight out in grants. The other half will be used to build a national wellbeing application, which will then allow individuals like yourselves or people that are listening or reading this to be able to access up to 401,000 different types of initiatives that will be able to support them in the treatment of their mental health or the management of their mental wellbeing.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means by that is that because there's so many community projects all around the UK, a lot of the time, a lot of people aren't aware of them.
Yeah.
So not only do we want to support them financially to be able to build their ideas, what we also want to do is raise the awareness of them. So yeah. This application is kind of twofold. It's about funding them, but it's also about bringing awareness and almost connecting the donor, our donors, to those projects as well.
Yeah.
Because again, not all the time, community projects don't always need money.
No.
Most of the time, someone's time or expertise is worth far more than that, because half the time these community projects, or the level that we're looking at,
mm-hmm.
they're one individual that does it as a part-time thing because they've got a job and yeah. they don't get paid for it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make the idea any less relevant
mm-hmm.
Or impactful. So, and on top of that, what we want to do is to bolster and support all of that. We want to build a 200-strong volunteer ambassador network, which will cover all 96 counties of the UK. And the jobs of those ambassadors will be to not only raise the awareness of the foundation, but look at projects within their areas that we can fund and support,
mm-hmm.
But also help us generate income through the likes of contactless giving, growing our, you know, other ways that we obviously gain funding through, which is through things like online giving platforms or, yeah, things like that. So, yeah, it's big plans for the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
But obviously, a lot of people may think that we should have grown a bit faster, but I think when you're trying to do something properly, you grow at the rate that you find you can.
Mm.
And actually, the last thing we want to do is it's almost a little bit like when you plan an ultra,
yeah.
Dare I say. And, you know, you don't think, oh, how fast am I going to go and do this? You're looking at the different points along the line and going, right, okay, so this is where I want to get to. This is then the next stage, and the next stage. And this is how we're doing this.
Yeah.
We haven't got a big team.
No.
So the capacity to be able to do a lot of this stuff is very small. And we have to generate income to be able to then, you know, invest into kind of key things. And we're very lucky that a lot of our supporters and followers, you know, understand that. But yeah, five years down the line, I think it's 2025, we're aiming to be able to hand out £1.5 million worth of grants a year, mm-hmm. which will support up to 750 local community projects around the UK. And the impact that will have will just be huge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the foundation's about. So that's, you know, all born from a TIA for the age of 20. Yeah. Nobody can ever turn around and say that nothing's possible. It's really just about you making sure that you just remove all the limits.
Yeah.
And things aren't always going to go right. Trust me, there's lots of stuff that's gone wrong, and there's mistakes that we've made, and, you know, stuff that we kick ourselves about. But that's life. That is life. And, no. You know, you do the best job you can. So
I don't know what your views on failure are, but I personally feel that you can't succeed without it.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the mentalities we put through the 401.
Okay.
So, you know, we were asked afterwards, oh, God, you know, we had good days and bad days. It was like, yeah, we did. We had pretty bad days.
Yeah.
Like, days where I just wanted to stay in the campervan and not come out, especially when it was raining and all my kit was wet from the previous day and I had nowhere to dry and I had to put wet kit back on. You know, we've all been, it's horrible.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not great. But then you have days where, you know, the sun's out or, you know, you're in the most beautiful part of the Highlands of Scotland, you know, I went to Glencoe, for God's sake, and the sun was out and it's glorious and beautiful. And, you know, you're just, everything's working and the body's working and you're like, oh, it's incredible. But like you just said, you can't appreciate the good stuff without having to go through the bad.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's the way I kind of view my life. You know, I went through what I went through for a reason at school. I'm not saying it was right.
No.
Didn't need to go through it. But what I've managed to do is take that and make a conscious choice. Not that it was easy,
no.
Because, you know, most of the time you only really hear of the stories of the people that succeed, don't you? You don't really hear about the ones that, you know, aren't able to make that choice. And no. I suppose that is ultimately what we're trying to do with the foundation as well. Make sure that more people have the ability to make the choices that are right for them.
Yeah. What about your own mental health? Do you still have low days, and have your coping mechanisms changed over the years?
Yeah, I think the honest answer to that is yes. I think anybody asking themselves, you know, that question, if the answer is anything other than that, you're probably lying. You know, and because we all have mental well-being, we all have mental health. You know, I liken mental well-being and mental health to a bit like sexuality, or the view of sexuality was, you know, 50 years ago. It was very kind of polarizing, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was very judgmental. It was very kind of, you were put into a box. If you were camp and effeminate and a man, you were clearly gay. If you were butch and into sport and a woman, you were clearly a, you know, individual doing about it.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're saying, you know, you're still finding that, you know, when somebody opens up and talks about mental health, the judgment is sometimes still there.
Yeah.
You know, because you think, oh, they're straight. You know, in the corner of the room. That's not mental health. That's, you know, that's one of the extremes.
Yeah.
You know, mental health is also you waking up one morning and feeling like you're going to have a bad day.
Yeah.
You know? So, with that in mind, again, coming back to foundation, we're all different.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we all will all suffer from our mental health at different times in our lives. Therefore, the treatment will be different. Therefore, giving people the ability to pick from a wide-ranging, you know, amount of projects in one location gives them the freedom and choice to be able to approach something. So,
absolutely.
Like for me, it was running,
mm-hmm.
that then gave you the ability to talk about things. It could be somebody joining a book club. It could be somebody, you know, going to a local community group. But taking it back to my mental well-being,
mm-hmm.
I still have time for days where I just probably overwhelmed and, you know, I struggle. But the difference now is I have a mechanism to support me in that. After the 401 challenge, I lost that. You know, for me, running was that thing for me.
Yeah.
And actually running 10,500 miles or halfway around the world, kind of, no pun intended, but it runs it out, yeah.
Literally.
So I lost the love of running afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of that was driven around this kind of having achieved a goal, needing to know what the next purpose in my life was.
Yeah.
But what I didn't have was the mechanism to be able to help me get to that point.
Okay.
So I struggled quite a lot afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But over the past couple of years, that love for running come back. You know, I use running as my filing time.
Yeah.
You know, if I've got a screwy brain, I'll put my trainers on, I'll go out for a run, and by the time I come back, it's like everything is just logically filed away and things that were overwhelming aren't so overwhelming anymore. And, you know, sometimes that helps, sometimes it doesn't. But what I also have is I have an incredible family. I have an incredible husband. Now, don't get me wrong, we have arguments, we fight and we do all of this, you know, as a normal household. But what I have is I know I have them behind me and with me at every step of the way in what I'm wanting to achieve. And actually, I know I can pick up the phone to any one of my friends and any one of my family and just say I'm having a crap day and they'll listen.
That's invaluable.
That's rich. And it's so important. It's so important. I have no shame about having a bad day anymore. No. And that is, again, it's just a statement, but it's such a big thing for me to say because the shame is what was debilitating. people.
Yeah, absolutely. Your new challenge. You said you're running a marathon in every state. Tell me about the logistics behind planning that challenge. I'm assuming it's ongoing.
The logistics are planned.
Happy days.
You know, we need to... It's the bit that I really enjoy, to be honest. The plan part. I really get excited about it because I get to build spreadsheets. Such a spreadsheet.
So, love a spreadsheet.
Love a spreadsheet, we work out exactly how each of the days will work. Mm-hmm. So, without going into too much detail, we are, because it's an unaided solo project,
mm-hmm.
It's very different to having a support team, which was initially the plan, to take a support team out with me. But just the cost and the viability of that, especially what with COVID and the impact that's had on us as an organisation, my personal business, by the way, not the charity, we decided that actually a solo mission was probably going to be what was required out of this. And luckily we managed to fund that throughout COVID, which was great. Every day's been planned.
Mm-hmm.
So that those days will be a mix of either just single cycle days, mm-hmm. Or run and cycle days. Mm-hmm. I think there is one day where it's a run, cycle, run. But that's at the very beginning. So the first kind of, we split the US into five different stages, each of which are 10 states long. If you think about the northeast of the US, mm-hmm. all the states are quite packed together.
Yeah.
So to run a marathon and then cycle to the next location, most of the time we kind of get there because it's not massively far. Okay. So maybe over just 100 miles or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I say not massively far, but you know what?
To an athlete of your level, it's not far at all.
I still laugh when people call me an athlete. I'm totally not an athlete. I just love what I do. So the first day, Augusta, just taking that as an example, I run a marathon in Augusta.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I know I said before I wouldn't want to run a marathon around a running track, but unfortunately in the US, that's what we're going to have to do.
Okay.
And the reason for that is basically down to time. So if you imagine 14,000 miles in 104 days, it's roughly about 135 miles a day.
Yeah.
We need to be able to recover.
Mm-hmm.
I need to be able to, so therefore, what I've had to do is plan an average mile on the bike, like a pace, an average pace on the bike, and an average mile pace of running, which is compatible to, me being able to have enough time after to feed myself, find food, deal with anything that I need to deal with, and recover and sleep as well. So I think what we've done is we've worked it out roughly on around 13 mile per hour average for the bike.
Okay.
And that's up and down hills.
Yeah.
And it's roughly around 10 minute miles for the marathon.
Okay.
There are breaks planned in throughout the days. But so obviously you can imagine on a run day, we would do less cycling than say just on a normal cycling day because a run takes longer to cover than say a longer cycle. So I believe the first day I run the marathon starting at 6 o'clock in the morning in Augusta, in Maine, at a high school around a running track, 106 times around that track, which will then split it into four, where we'll run, 10K in one direction, then I'll switch and run 10K in the other to kind of help with the making sure I don't just end up
the body balance.
I run around in circles my whole life, basically.
Yeah.
We aim to invite people to come to that marathon, so people from the local community. And then what I will do is after I finish that marathon, I'll get on a bike. And I believe it's a 110-mile cycle that day to a hotel in Lancaster, which is in New Hampshire, which is about 40 miles short of Montpellier in Vermont, which is the next day capital. And then the following morning, I wake up, cycle the 40 miles to Vermont, to Montpellier, get to the high school there, run the marathon around there, get on the bike and cycle to Bradford, which I believe is in New Hampshire. Yeah, so New Hampshire, Vermont. So that's kind of how it works.
Okay.
So Yeah, I worked my way from Augusta all the way down to kind of Tallahassee in Florida. And then worked my way all the way back up to kind of, where is it, up into Michigan, then all the way back down to kind of Mississippi, Louisiana, then all the way back up to kind of South Dakota, North Dakota, then back down to kind of Colorado, into kind of New Mexico, and then from kind of New Mexico back up through the kind of western parts, which are bigger states.
Yeah.
Into Alaska. That's going to be an interesting one. And then penultimate state is California, Sacramento. And then we fly to Hawaii to do the final marathon in Honolulu. So, yeah, it's there's still some logistics to plan with regard to, you know, how we drop kit in. Because if you imagine now it's a solo mission, I'm not going to have the ability to carry kit as well as what I could have done if I had a support crew. So we're going to look at certain drops to drop kit in, so I've got the right kit to wear in the right climates. Because again, in America, it's such a vast country, I'm covering so many different types of climates.
Yeah,
we've done risk assessments by state. We've even planned all the routes, because all the roads, you could be on a road. All the laws for the roads are different in most states and in some counties within those states. So basically, you could be cycling on a road, but not able to fight on that road once you do that.
Wow.
So you're a bit like, okay. So we've had to do all of this. Let's hope they don't change it. But yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, and then we've just had to get the technology to kind of support all of that. We're looking at building the team here in the UK to make sure that, you know, we've already got a PR and a marketing team, which I know you've had connections with, on board, and they're going to be supporting us with, you know, publicising what it is that we're doing, you know, and keeping it alive in the UK.
Yeah.
But then on top of all of that, that's the challenge. We actually are trying to keep it alive here in the UK, and I believe on the 10th of May we will be launching a virtual school mission where we will allow for 200,000 young people between the ages of 5 and 18 to be able to come and get involved in the USA Challenge by in their year groups covering 14,000 miles, which is the official course, using a virtual platform, and over 110 different alternative activities. That's so not just running or cycling, it could be baking, it could be changing the bed, it could be yoga, it could be anything like that. We have laid it all, but it's about bringing to life the project to those young people over the next academic school year, and then once that school year finishes, that's when I will then be in the US. So not only will they get weekly updates throughout the school year of me training and the involvement in this project, and the ability to win prizes and all this type of stuff, but then they'll get daily updates from me while I'm in the States. They get to live and breathe it. And actually, when you think about instilling confidence and self-esteem and belief that a young person can do anything they want to do, watching this entire journey, seeing the ups and downs, which is the reality in life, hopefully instill them with that confidence to not have to give up or to go, I failed. That's what we want. It's about changing. It's about changing that. You know, again, it's a big statement, but if we can instill confidence and self-esteem in our younger generation, they're the ones that are the future. They're the ones that are going to make these amazing positive changes.
Absolutely.
We just need to get rid of the doubt in their minds, which unfortunately is plagued. So.
Well, if you think about how much of a difference it would have made for our generation, if we'd been taught that in schools, you know?
Yeah.
I know it was greatly missing from my childhood, certainly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it comes, you know, the education system has changed massively, especially over the past couple of years. You know, you've seen a massive change in the way Ofsted, you know, marks schools.
Yeah.
You know, there is debate. I think it's great. Good, but there's definitely more of a leaning towards the mental well-being of young people being at the centre of everything.
Yeah.
And if you actually think about it, our mental health affects everything in our lives, whether or not that's us recovering from cancer or to, you know, dealing with a problem. Everything is based on our mental well-being. So the fact that needs to be part, front and centre of everything that we do is a no-brainer.
Absolutely.
But trying to change the behaviours and attitudes of some people, it is quite difficult.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
What are you training? What does it look like? Does it consist of running something else and cycling, or is it all running? Or
yeah. Well, it's three things. So it's strength and conditioning training in the gym.
Right.
So I do CrossFit.
Right.
I just find it, a lot of people have very different views on CrossFit, but it's an amazing CrossFit. And the trainers are incredible. They're really good. And actually, I was a bit worried because I have issues with the lower part of my back.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, I'm going to go to CrossFit and you'll get all these horror stories. And actually, they don't make you do anything until you do it properly.
No.
And that's amazing. And they take you through everything prior to you actually doing it. So I'm very lucky to have that.
Mm-hmm.
So I do a minute to, well, we just came out this week.
Yep.
Which is,
yeah. Woohoo!
And I've got numbers today, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
I feel like everything weighs fun today. So everything gains. But so there's that. And the plan is to, for the next 8 weeks, to do two sessions of about a week. And okay. Then to up it to three for the following 8 weeks. And then it'll be up to four sessions across the week. Up until probably around about 3 months prior to me going, and then they'll be reduced. But that's just so that I can make sure that, you know, I'm strong in the areas that I need to be, like my core and my back. And I've been sitting on the bike running a lot of the time.
Yeah.
On top of that, it's about really getting the legs, the miles in my legs from the running perspective. So for the past kind of 5 weeks, my training properly started 5 weeks ago when we actually realized we'd funded.
Okay.
I've been, you know, ticking over basically for quite a few years and just going out for enjoyable runs. But now it's a case of just, I up my mileage by 1 mile a week, you know, and it'll take me up to roughly around about 80 miles by the time I'm going.
Yeah.
Which isn't anywhere near what, you know, I'm going to be running while I'm out there in some weeks, but, you know, running is the bit that I find easy.
Yeah.
That's the map, sorry. It's the bit that I'm better at. The cycling, that's a toughie. And, you know, that's that 12,000 plus miles of the next challenge. So, again, you know, we've used the same mentality to just get used to the bike.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a problem with my bike since November, unfortunately. I've been without it because of all the supply issues. I had a crash in November, and that meant that my bike ended up in the shop and we weren't able to get a part, so I've had to buy a new one. But that's arrived, and actually it's built, and I got a message yesterday, and it came through on my watch. It was hi Ben, your bike is ready. And I went, I've never been so happy. So I picked my bike up tomorrow. Then it'll just be on the road.
Okay.
Building mileage each week. I think the most mileage I get to in a week is about 700 miles, my training plan.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's relentless. It's a relentless training program matched with, and it's not based around kind of any training program that are out there.
No.
It's just based around what I feel is right for me and using my experience of big challenges and what I felt I needed.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that I've learned over the years, that I've put it together. And it also means it can be flexible too. So if I find that something isn't working, I can switch it and change it. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Do you have a specific diet that kind of matches your training program? Do your calories go up?
Just eat whatever I can, to be perfectly honest with you. I think
happy
because,
days.
You know, we're anticipating I burn around 10,000 calories a day in the US.
Right. Calories.
It would be, I burned 6,000 a day while I was doing the 401. And
yeah.
I suppose what I found the first 50 days during the 401 challenge was the fact that I wasn't eating enough. I was following a predisposed idea of what diet I should be. You know, eat lots of carbs because, you know, that's what gives you energy. It's like, well, no, my body was burning fat. I needed my body to burn fat as a fuel source because it was more effective.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I'll be switching to try and allow it to do that. I'm not in that current point where I'm doing that at the minute.
No.
I'm just literally watching what I eat,
mm-hmm.
making sure that my protein intake is is at the level it needs to be able to repair my muscles from what I'm asking them to do right now. I'm eating healthily, which I do anyway. Yeah. But however, we have a takeout once a week. You know, which is
much
great.
Like most people in Britain, I should imagine.
Exactly. Yeah. I think, you know, I don't get so fussed about my diet.
No.
I think a lot of people can get very overwhelmed with the idea of food and exercise. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, there is a bit of something brewing, unfortunately, out there where people are now starting to think, oh, well, if I exercise, I'll be able to eat that. And that's just not very healthy
Have
of stuff. So, you know, I stay well clear of that, and I use food to fuel me, not to feel good.
You need more protein if you have DOMS today. Much more protein.
I got in from, so I've actually been doing, in order, part of funding America is for me to try and go get a part-time job. Obviously, you can imagine the impact that COVID's had on social speaking and, you know, events and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we still have them, but we just don't have them at the capacity that we used to. So our business has overheads it has to cover. So I've gone and got a part-time job delivering Amazon Flex parcels. Before this interview, I had a 2.5-hour shift. I was in about 5 minutes before the interview.
Oh, no.
So I was getting ready to have a shake. But then I went, damn, I can't have it now. I've got to go and do the interview, so I have it after this. So,
you should have brought your shake along. Oh, good.
I swear, I didn't have time. I hate being late.
Yeah, I'm the same. Do you do anything that you... to increase your mental strength for this challenge? Do you do anything mentally on a normal basis?
Not at the minute. My mental strength is quite good.
I can imagine that.
That helps me with it.
Okay.
The fact that it's also training is great. You know,
yeah.
You know, we have been looking at a few things like yoga or meditation and stuff like that. And if it's something that I find I need and I have the time to do it, then I'm open to it.
Absolutely.
But I'm in capacity at the moment, really, with what I can handle. And I think, again, that's part of me managing my mental well-being. It's understanding my limits. It's understanding when I've hit capacity.
That's good.
And then it's realizing that actually if I need to achieve something more, what is going to have to give, or what do I have to make something more, what do I have to make more efficient in order to be able to still retain that, but actually reduce the time. And it's quite, I suppose, a bit of a pragmatic way of looking at it.
You've got your route planned, as you've just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything specific about finishing in Hawaii that you planned it that way?
So we looked at kind of prevailing winds, basically.
Okay.
And, you know,
makes sense.
This when we went to east west, we're like, ooh, we don't want to do that. If wind comes to coastal west week, and I'm like, I kind of went, no, it doesn't. It really doesn't. But actually, look at the map of the wind from there, it goes like this.
Okay.
But it does move from west to east because that, if you overlay our route, we kind of follow it.
Okay.
Slightly opposite. So there's probably times where we have winds and stuff like that, of course, but you know. But we've also based it on the river. So even though I am, you know, taking this over 104 days, not the United States 120 days because I've got days on the side.
Of course.
When you look at states like the southern states, you have the tornadoes and things like that, it was very difficult for us to plan it where we wouldn't be states when that happens, but where we it's the lesser of a bad period. If that makes any sense.
It does,
Also, kind of heading towards the sun, towards, you know, warmer weather is something that motivates me. Starting Hawaii, we would run the marathon in Hawaii, and then I'd have to get on a plane and fly back. California.
Yeah.
And for me, it was in California then. You know, it makes the logical sense for us to start in May and follow. Plus, also, we have stage one done
Is there a particular part that you're looking forward to, a particular state that you're expecting to visit?
Honestly, I'm looking forward to it all.
Okay.
But obviously, you look at some of the people take from the United States, Montana and Utah and Colorado and things like that. But then there's states that I've got no clue what they look like Kentucky or West Virginia, or, you know, I've been to Miami and Florida. A lot of these states, they have such charm to them that actually I think they'll be things that I will see that I don't think I ever would have thought I would.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
Don't get me wrong, I am nervous. I am nervous because the States is such a big place and it's a different country. It's a different attitude towards certain things.
Yeah.
And actually, again, with this being a solo project, that is always going to be on the back of my mind.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that they freely allow guns in the US. You know, we don't have that problem here. We don't have that in the UK.
No.
So it's something, again, that has to be part of the plan.
Yeah.
You know, I understand the laws in the UK. I'm not completely up to speed on the laws in the US.
Yeah.
And actually, you don't want to know somebody has been wrong, but every state is slightly different.
Definitely.
So, you know, the thing I'm most nervous about is people's attitudes towards me.
Yeah.
Not necessarily challenging its sense.
They'll love it.
Yeah, I'm sure they will, but it's also, you know, and I'm hoping I don't take it as a disservice to anyone, but, you know, we all watch American TV.
Yes,
we all watch dramas about small-town America and, you know, their attitudes or things or police forces being corrupt or this and that. And I know it's all dramatized with TV, but, yeah, it does make you wonder. But then that's all part of the challenge.
Wow. Yeah.
I have no doubt that I'm going to meet some incredible people, and the Americans will open their arms to this project. And in places where I thought I won't find support, I will find incredible, you know, acts of human kindness, because that's just what people are like, and it's the minority that tarnish it. It was like that in the UK before I won. There were parts of the UK I was a bit like, oh god,
yeah,
don't know about that, but it's like. I had the best time. And actually, it was amazing.
Yeah.
You know, so human beings are ignorant people at heart. And stuff you idiots. That's what you should have. Unfortunately, the life can't do it for everyone else.
Yeah. Oh, how do you handle sleep deprivation? What are the sleeping plans? Do you have any?
I have no problem sleeping.
Do you handle.
I find it's funny, actually. 401 challenge, as my body started to put out what it was I was trying to do, my sleep started to change. You know, in the very beginning of the first day, I couldn't get enough sleep, but then slowly, but surely after that, it was the very, very end where actually I was struggling with sleep because running a marathon just became so normal to me and my body that. You know, it was like I was walking down the shop to go and get a can of milk.
Yeah.
You know, it was like. So, because we're only out for 104 days and because of the intensity of the project, I don't think I'm going to come to that point as quickly.
No.
So, however, what will be a challenge will be if we overrun on certain days and then don't get the ability to recover quick enough in time for the next day. And that's stuff we're still having to look at. Because. You know, I was able to liaise with over 200 UK therapists throughout the last challenge, and they volunteered their time to give me a massage. I'm not going to be able to do that in the US.
No.
So I'm going to have to take something that's going to have to help me with that, whether or not that's, you know, a kind of 10-star machine or, you know, one of the massage guns or, you know, was looking at, or, you know, massages on days where, you know, draft days where which we planned as days off and stuff. We don't know. That's all be kind of worked out still, really.
That makes sense. Yeah. You want to raise £500,000 for charity? Do you have a page? Is it open? Do you have a link that we can share?
Not Not yet. No, so we actually plan to launch the page at the beginning of 2020. When's the date? I think it's later on this year we plan to open the page.
Okay.
The reason for that is because it's the school's involvement as well.
Okay.
So
yeah.
We will be starting to write the school program.
Mm-hmm.
It will be free. Well, the aim will be it's free to schools, but yeah. Whether or not that's funded by the likes of the free, which we're applying for a grant for, or whether or not that will be done through local sponsors, i.e., local teachers want to sponsor a school.
Yeah.
We'll ultimately, we'll get the program for free. Great. That's exactly what we want. And then, kind of, they'll start in September, and then in kind of November, December time, we'll then go back to schools and approach. To be a complete choice if you want to, if they don't, they don't.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, if we had 401 schools on board raising £1,000 each, you know, which is very doable within the school year.
Absolutely.
About the money schools do raise.
Definitely.
Especially even during the current climate, for all the reasons that they're trying to raise as well.
Yeah.
You know, that accounts for £401,000 for £500,000 target.
Yeah.
And we'll easily be able to raise the further 99,000 through the incredible support and sponsors, the incredible support of donors and supporters that we have. So I feel very confident, but you know, we don't know how schools are going to take the program. We don't know if we'll get 401 schools on board, but that's, you know, that's the goal.
Definitely. Please do let us know when it launches and we can kind of include that on your online piece.
No, thank you. Yeah, so it'll be the 10th of May that it launches. So we're actually launching it on the day, on the year to go day, basically.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The 10th of May. So it'll become available on the foundation website. But that is actually owned and operated by the 401 Foundation. That's actually a funding program that, yeah. But it's got loads of resources for the school, lots of maps for the kids to kind of track themselves around. They've got badges. Even the primary school kids have got their own passport that they get to track their miles in every day.
Lovely.
So, you know, we try to make it as interactive as possible, but also empower the young kids to be able to kind of take ownership of their own physical activity, because that's the way that you change someone's attitude towards sport or activity as a whole.
Yeah.
You know, it's about how do we incorporate it into life rather than make it something that you think, oh God, I've got to do. And this, again, is another reason why we view technology, because we hear it all the time. People moan about the fact that our younger kids spend more time in front of screens than we did.
Yeah.
Of course they do. That's the world we live in. It's, you know, my argument there is that, you know, stop fighting to take the screen away. Incorporate and be creative in the ways that you can include physical activity into that screen. You look at the likes of Pokemon Go or the potential of Harry Potter Go that's coming out.
Yeah.
You know, yes, you're still walking around the screen. How do all the kids walking outside? You know, our program hopes to do something very similar by using an online virtual platform that the kids can kind of log into and you know, see how far they've gone and where they fit on the actual 14,000 mile course. They can even zoom in and see the street view of where they are, and they can go off exploring, which is, you know, amazing. So it's quite cross-curricular as well. It incorporates all the different types of subjects taught in primary and secondary school. So yeah, it depends on how flexible and how creative the teachers want to be with it, really.
Yeah, really amazing initiative and very look at it. It's gonna be awesome.
Thanks. Well, I am so.
Can you?
I hope so.
We know so. There's such a massive support and a following. I think it's going to be a massive success. Or it should be.
Yeah. I hope so. I'm really, I'm fingers crossed. We've done so much work and we've spoke to so many people and, you know, we didn't want to design something that's just going to be a waste.
No.
It needs to tick so many boxes. The challenge now is how we market it.
Yeah.
How we clearly and concisely get to the public, because I know for well once they go in, and once you get it, it's a no-brainer.
Absolutely.
But it's getting them to know it And that's what our kind of marketing team is working on at the moment. So, yeah, they're really good. So I've got no doubt they'll be able to make sure it's a success.
It really does sound amazing. It really does. Finally, can you offer some advice to somebody who wants to step up from marathon to ultra or do a multi-stage kind of back-to-back marathon the way you do? Maybe not like 401 of them, but, you know.
Then you'll understand. It won't be less of a lonely place to be.
No. No.
When everybody goes, oh, I don't know, I'm sorry. I don't mean in an horrible way, but what I mean is, you know, again, a lot of people have said in the past, you know, what if somebody goes and beats it? I'm like, please
do.
Somebody go and beat it. Please do it. I suppose my advice, I think. I think the first thing really is whether or not that's what I want to do.
Absolutely.
You know, because again, is that a decision that's being governed by someone else pressurizing you to do it, or for you actually wanting to do it?
Mm.
And if it's you actually wanting to do it, then you know half the battle's fought straight away,
yeah.
And half the battle's won. You know, there's the general things such as making sure that you fuel yourself properly, that you work out what's right for you rather than just listening or being dictated to all the time by, you know, what you think you should be doing. I found it quite easy to step up into running a little further. A lot of it just ended up being in my head, thinking, oh, I don't know if I'll be able to do that because I know how it feels to run a marathon.
Yeah.
And actually, you can take that at any level. So, you know, somebody who runs a 5K thinks, I can't go and double that. But when you actually run a 10K, you don't run it at twice. You don't run it at the same pace as a 5K. And I suppose that's the mentality. It's understanding that with an ultra, it's not about, well, to some people it is about how fast you do it, but it's about the experience.
Yeah.
It's about the fun. It's about the cake. It's about the pork pie. Wow, all that.
It really is.
You know? Oh, yeah, completely. And actually, that's the fun of it all. The sociability of the stations in ultramarathon are amazing.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think A, find out if it is what you want to do. And then B, just have fun.
Eat the pork pies.
Oh, definitely. Oh, love a pork pie.
We know what you're going to fuel your America challenge on now.
I'm sorted. I'm there.
Yeah, I think that's why most ultra runners run, to be honest. It's the food. Always the food.
Yeah, definitely. I tried to instill that into the 401 challenge because it actually became quite renowned. Mm. I mean, it's in the book. There's some pictures in the book, actually, in the central part of the book of me eating massive English breakfasts.
Nice.
And you know, I'd run 10K, or I'd run half a marathon and I'd have a fish and chip dinner. And people would be like, how can you do that? And they'd be like, well, I need to get the calories in somehow. And it was because I put the fun in, I took away the pressure, I took away the time, and almost put in this ultra quality of making sure I fuel my body to help it achieve what I wanted to achieve.
Yeah.
Oh, I miss the days of being able to eat anything I want to do. You know, when it comes to America, any place in the world where I'm going to need 10,000 calories a day, I'm going to be able to fill that straight off the bat.
100%.
It'll
be the best part of the challenge.
I might do a competition to see where, you know, which state's got the best chicken wings.
Yes.
You never know. Might get a chicken wing bucket affixed to the front of my bike, you know, so I can just eat and cycle at the same time. I don't know. We'll see.
You should definitely do that. It'll attract all the greedy ultra runners and go, oh, yeah, I want to go there, you know. Like me.
Yeah.
Love chicken wings.
Mississippi wings.
You'll have to pay for them, though. I'm not paying for your wings.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Come and support me, but don't eat my food. Not cool. It doesn't share food. Get off. I appreciate the support, but not that much. All right, calm down.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today. It's been amazing.
Oh, no.
And you.